All right, welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. This is episode 127. Today we have a guest, Brother Brian Kennard, and he is the author of Steinbeck, Citizen Spy, and the owner of Grave Distractions Publishing Company. It's a great interview, and I can say if you were one of those people who loved the conspiracy segments that we used to do, which we now do only on the Winding Stairs podcast, then you will love this interview. Before we get into that, I want to quickly mention that I have a couple of new sections on the website, wcypodcast.com, one of which is the presentation schedule. I don't do a whole lot of presentations, but when I do, they will be listed here. I am not a historian or an expert in any particular field, but I do compose some research on occasion, and I'll do presentations. So, this year, my presentation is about Freemasonry and colonial America and the taverns that we started in. If this interests you, then you can check the schedule out there and you can see when and where they will be. And if it sounds like something that you want for your lodge, just shoot me an email. I don't charge for tickets or anything, but if a lodge that I'm speaking at does, I'm sure it's for their charities or something like that. I assure you, I don't take any money for my presentations. Simply being able to spend time with brothers is my payment. So again, if you want, check that out. Again, I do work a 40-hour a week job as well, so if I can't do a presentation this year, I might be able to do it next year. So the second tab that we recently put up is our Support the Show tab. From here, you can see all of the ways that we support the show. There are the show apps, which not only let you stream the show, but also download additional bonus content like Masonic wallpapers and the papers that we read on the show via PDF. Another way which is popular is through our affiliate with FreemasonryArt.com. If you go to FreemasonryArt.com and you pick up any number of things, whether it's an awesome Masonically themed print or the new contemporary lambskin apron that Juan is offering, you can use the promo code WCY and you will get 10% off, as well as a little bit comes back to this show to fund us. If you don't know, FreemasonryArt.com is run by the host and producer of the Winding Stairs podcast, Brother Juan Sepulveda. He is a fine artist, and that is his job. It is his main source of income. He is a professional artist. He has gallery viewings, etc. I have to say that I have some of Brother Juan's art hanging in my office, and so does Brother Brian Shimian from the Midnight Freemasons. In fact, Brother Brian has the whole set. So check it out. No special links, just go over to www.freemasonryart.com, and when you check out, use code WCY, and that's it. You get a deal, you support the show, and you're going to get something made by a brother for a brother. Of course, our other affiliate is through Onnit Labs. So onnit.com, you click through the links on the WCYpodcast.com under the Support the Show tab. Pick any number of the quality healthy living products. These aren't late-night infomercial pills claiming to take off all of your unwanted pounds. These are supplements that are healthy and assist you in doing the work. I use a few of the products myself, like Alpha Brain, which basically is a vitamin for your brain. It gives me the focus that I might get from, say, maybe a few espressos, only without the caffeine, without the jitters, etc. Everything that they offer is all natural. Another product they make that I love is Hemp Force Protein. I know you hear the word hemp and you might be thinking something else, but I assure you there is no THC in Hemp Force Protein. It's simply a high-grade, slow-burning protein source that tastes great. It's all natural, there's no GMOs, and I think something like 95% of everything that Onnit makes is certified vegan. So if you're a vegan, or maybe you just rarely eat meat like me, you're covered. You click through those links, and when you check out, use promo code WCY. And again, that's 10% off as well there. And a little portion comes back to the show, keeps the lights on. Of course, there are other ways of supporting the show as well, one of which being a direct donation through PayPal. And on that note, I have to thank a few brothers, most recently, Brother Stephen Queensberry and Brother Derek. Thanks, fellas, for your donations. So where does the money that we raise go? It always goes into this show. What does that mean? Well, it pays for the hosting costs and the production of the show apps. It pays for the equipment and upgrades, etc. In fact, in case you didn't see it, I announced a few days back that I invested some of the donation into a new mixing board for the show's production. Quality has always been huge on my list of important things for this show. That's why I record the show in stereo and at the highest bitrate I can. One of the things, though, that has always bothered me was the telephone interviews. No matter what I did, I couldn't get them to sound as good as I wanted. This new mixer will allow us to bring that quality much higher, and that is where you will notice the change. I wasn't able to use it for the interview on today's show, but rest assured, This is the tool we will use from now on out. Also, the mixer will allow for multiple person guests, like roundtable discussion. I think you guys will all approve when you hear the difference. Well, I'm done yammering on. Here is the interview with Brother Brian Kennard.
All right, everybody. Today we are talking with Brother Brian Kennard, author of Steinbeck, Citizen Spy. So first of all, anyone listening, I just want to preface this with a little something that isn't known to everyone, but John Steinbeck was an American Pulitzer Prize-winning author who wrote several well-known books like Of Mice and Men, Grapes of Wrath, East of Eden. He was also a Freemason. So we're talking again with Brother Brian Kennard, and he wrote a book about Steinbeck and his affiliations with the CIA, I guess. Brother Brian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, anytime, man. When I got email and I heard about your book, I was really interested because a lot of the guys that listen to the show are very into the conspiracy side of things. And we used to do a segment called Masonic Conspiracies. I actually stopped doing the segment because I'm doing it for another Masonic program that's on. And I didn't want to kind of double them up, but I've got some emails from people wondering where are the conspiracies and stuff, but even though this isn't really a conspiracy because you've got like ample proof, but it's still very interesting. But I did want to just say thanks for spending some time. I know I was a little bit behind this morning. Anybody listening, I was supposed to call Brian at about 11. It's about 11:30 now, so I'm a little half hour behind, but thanks again for being understanding about that.
Not a problem.
Before we jump right into the book, can you tell us a little bit about your story, your lodge, and what kind of led you into writing? And you're also a publishing company, so.
Sure. I'm a member of Doric Lodge number 732 in Nashville, Tennessee. Also a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason. And my story is a little bit unusual. I ran small businesses and corporate businesses for years and was with the same company for 11 years. And 4 years ago, I decided that was not what I wanted to do with my life anymore. So I had a nice little discussion with my wife and realized how miserable I was. And she said, why don't you just quit? And I never thought about that. Right. Just quit. And I said, well, what would I do? And she said, well, what do you want to do? And, you know, nobody's asked me that since high school or college. What do I want to be when I grow up? And I had been working on my first book, Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. And I said, well, I guess I want to finish writing that and see where that leads. She said, well, do it. So about a month later, I quit a rather lucrative job and finished my first book and realized that I had the skill set to do all the functions of publishing for it. So after I published that, I thought, well, what am I going to do next? I thought, well, I can do the exact same thing that I did for myself for other folks and open up Grave Distractions Publications. And 60 books and 20-some-odd authors later, we're a thriving little publishing house. And we do everything from, we have one Masonic title out there called Walking with the Lotus Sun by wife of a past master of Center Star Lodge here in Nashville, to a guest on Ancient Aliens, who's also a brother, Reverend Michael Carter, his book Alien Scriptures, to the world's authority on the Dead Sea Scrolls, Dr. Robert Eisenman. We have reprinted just about all of his catalog at this point. So it's been an interesting 4 years, and it's a lot better than working for the man, so to speak.
Yeah, I think so.
But my interest in Steinbeck goes back 6 or 7 years, and I knew about as much about Steinbeck as any high school college graduate did. You know, forced to read The Grapes of Wrath and Of Mice and Men in high school and college. And
when I was in high school, Of Mice and Men was required reading. Actually, it was 8th grade. And when it came around to the actual high school time for that, we had to watch the movie, and it had Gary Sinise in it. And it was very interesting to watch a screen adaptation of such a great book. But also, I think that was the first time when people actually saw. Because in 8th grade, most people just buy, you know, they get on the internet. My age group, I'm 32, so when I was in 8th grade, a lot of kids, you know, we all had internet and stuff, so people would just get on there and they'd go read, you know, the Cliff Notes.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't get the how powerful of a story that was, but when they watched the movie, they were forced to sit there and watch it. If anybody's never read Of Mice and Men, I mean, It's a book that really pushes the envelope as far as social kind of attitudes in the time period and set, and also I don't want to ruin anything, but the ending of that book is, it tears your heart apart.
It does, and Steinbeck was such a great observer of humanity, and he wrote about people he knew about. For the book, I was able to interview his son, Thomas, and he talked about a number of the characters in various books that John had written, that Tom had met over his life, and John had based some of those characters on. But you're right, it conveys an emotion and just this laser focus on a person's soul in his works that years later drew me back to Steinbeck. And his interest in Arthurian legend, which is something that I'm very interested in. I was in a used bookstore in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and was looking for a copy of Cannery Row, there was a movie adaptation that was done in the early 80s with Nick Nolte of that, and was looking for a copy of the book, and ran across Steinbeck's rewrite of Malory's L'Amour d'Arthur, which is called The Acts of King Arthur and His Noble Knights. I thought, wow, I didn't realize Steinbeck was interested in Malory. So I picked up a copy of that and started doing some research on Steinbeck on and off over the years. And was very interested in how Steinbeck got to that point in his life where he was interested in Malory. And I would actually, instead of going to weekend trips to the beach or to the mountains, I would go to Stanford University's archives and look at Steinbeck original letters, or the New York Public Library's special collections section, where his research assistant for that project had willed his notebook and some of his research materials and letters during the time period John was writing that. And along the way, I realized that there was a lot more to John Steinbeck than just being an author. And the true aha moment was I'd known that Steinbeck was involved with the intelligence community during World War II. And I'd looked at Steinbeck's FBI file, which is available to anybody through the FBI's vault website. There's hundreds of celebrities and historical figures the FBI has opened up their files to, and anybody can go online and look at that now. And I'd read it half a dozen times for content, and I thought, let me look at this one more time from the viewpoint of who's requesting information and where is this information going to. And I saw something that I'd never really paid that much attention to before, but there are a number of instances where the CIA has redacted or removed information from Steinbeck's FBI file. And I thought, why in the world would the CIA be interested in Steinbeck? Now, when he wrote The Grapes of Wrath, there was a considerable flap about that, and a lot of people thought that Steinbeck was a communist or a communist sympathizer back in the 30s and 40s. I thought, well, maybe that was why. So I started digging into other people's FBI files that might have, and the CIA might have an interest in. Take, for example, Desi Arnaz from the I Love Lucy series and Desi Lu Productions. He was a Cuban national that was involved with the Free Cuba movement after Castro came to power. So I thought, well, if anybody would be interested in his connections, it would be the CIA. There were no redactions in his file from the CIA or for national security reasons, which there are over 20 instances in Steinbeck's FBI file of either specific CIA redactions or redactions for national security purposes. So I looked at other celebrities during the time period and could not find a single CIA redaction. I even looked at Albert Einstein's CIA file, and there are only two instances in Einstein's file, which is 1,500 pages long, and Steinbeck's is about 200 pages. And I only found two with Einstein. So what made Steinbeck so special to the CIA? Well, continued to do research and could not quite answer that question. So at the beginning of 2012, I sent a Freedom of Information Act request to the Central Intelligence Agency, basically asking them about all the information that they had on Steinbeck. And the process is kind of arduous, and every month or so I get a letter from the CIA saying, oh, we've received your request, and we've got something for you. And in August of 2012, I received two letters from the CIA, one was in Steinbeck's own hand, written to Walter Beadle Smith, who was director of Central Intelligence, in 1952 when the letter was written, requesting service with the CIA during an upcoming trip he was planning for spending about 6 months in Europe. And
Steinbeck, at this point, has offered his services to the CIA.
Yes. It's red and black and white, his handwriting, confirmed by the CIA and his son Tom, that's John Steinbeck's writing on the same letterhead. I'd seen numerous other letters of his. And the other letter that was included in this package was from Walter Beadle Smith accepting Steinbeck's offer and basically saying, yes, you can be of great service by keeping your eyes and ears open, if you could take some time and visit us before your trip and definitely afterwards, we'd be greatly appreciative. So that's the smoking gun, and there's not much more proof that's needed than the director of Central Intelligence saying, yeah, sure, work for it. And I was able to speak with an ex-CIA intelligence officer during the process of writing the book, and he was active from the Eisenhower to early Reagan administration. And I asked him specifically about Steinbeck, and he didn't know specifically anything that Steinbeck had done. However, he did tell me that, one, there were a drove of citizen spies that were used by the CIA during the 1950s to gather intelligence. And we go back in the history of the CIA very, very briefly. It was created in 1947 and grew out of the OSS that operated during World War II and gathered intelligence and did covert operations during the war. Well, the CIA was in its infancy then, and they weren't very well funded. They were trying to get their mechanisms up and running, and one of the ways they found to do that was to use people from the Greatest Generation, a lot of World War II veterans out there, that would travel abroad, journalists, engineers, people in academia, and these people were called walk-ins, and they would either offer their services to the agency, or the agency would seek them out if there was a specific purpose. Like, let's say you have an aerospace engineer that was going to an international conference in Copenhagen. The CIA might send an operative to talk to him and say, hey, when you're there, could you talk to this person? Or could you just listen for these topics and report back to us? And a vast majority of those citizen spies during that time period were passive intelligence gatherers. And this is the category, to a certain extent, that Steinbeck fulfilled, although I believe later on he did do some more active things, and there's evidence, too, that Steinbeck's relationship with the intelligence community that began actually in 1940 and all throughout World War II, continued on from the time period of the end of the war until 1952, and I believe it even went as far as to his two trips to Russia in 1947 and 1964.
Wow. So he was involved quite a long time. And it sounds, you know, it's kind of interesting, too, the way you mentioned it, you know, the CIA being in infancy, going to that a little bit, that people were, you know, just offering up their services to the Central Intelligence Agency, very similar to when our United States military was initially just getting started, and you just had people coming in off the street offering to fight for the country. The Cold War is starting. People are offering their services to a fledgling starting organization in the United States.
Well, and if you think about the group of people that we're talking about, somewhere between 10 to 12% of American males were in uniform during World War II. And we're talking about a group of very patriotic individuals that volunteered, for the most part, to go to war then. So their mindsets are not changing, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years after the end of World War II. These are the same guys that have, in some cases, very, very specialized training. And they're combat veterans in a lot of cases, too. They've been, in a number of cases, pre-vetted for security clearances during the war. So this is a group of individuals that we're talking about, and the CIA would have been foolish not to have capitalized on that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you said, especially if they were specially trained individuals already, why would you say no?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the other things that my CIA, ex-CIA contact kind of clued me into, and I looked into this a little closer after speaking with him. Unfortunately, I can't reveal what his name is, but I assure you he is a very, very real individual that Hoots talked to. But he also told me that a book that Steinbeck wrote about his 1947 trip to the Soviet Union, a Russian, or the Russian journal, was used as kind of a CIA spook summer reading list title. It was actually high-level intelligence officers would give this book or recommend this book to field operatives to read. Well, I did a little more digging into that, and coincidentally enough, who was the ambassador to Russia during the time period that Steinbeck was in the Soviet Union in 47? But Walter Beadle Smith, the same person in 1952 that he writes to requesting service.
Point. Like, in my mind, you've seen those movies where people have all the photos on their office wall, and they have the yarn going to every photo, connecting all these things. It's starting to happen in my brain right now.
And that's kind of how researching and writing the book went, because there are any number of those type connections that Steinbeck is one degree of separation away from the agency at any given point, or intelligence services. But if you read a Russian or the Russian journal, it almost reads like Steinbeck is trying to gather intelligence. He goes to the famous Stalingrad tractor factory where some of the most bitter fighting of World War II happened between the Russians and the Germans there. And Steinbeck mentions things like they're still melting down German tanks for steel, what type of machinery they're using, what they're producing. And Steinbeck even laments in the book that he can't get better production figures.
If he writes this journal, do you think that it was actually a way he put together a journal with very specific information in almost the easiest and most covert way of releasing information to U.S. was to just publish a book, almost like hide it in the open?
Well, and I think that was part of the reason. Steinbeck had contracted with the New York Herald Times to go to Russia and write a series of articles about what life inside the Soviet Union was. And remember, we're talking about 1947, the Iron Curtain has just fallen, and very, very few journalists were allowed into the interior of the Soviet Union. Journalists at that time were limited to Moscow, and they had to have special dispensation and a guide from the Soviet government to travel about. Steinbeck had a guide, but he also kind of had free reign to go where he wanted, because the Soviets thought that it would be a great propaganda coup, and Steinbeck would write how great the Soviet Union was. Well, he did just the opposite. He wrote what he saw.
Right.
And
something that's still happening today, when people go over there, like tourists, they get treated very well. And it happened all through the 80s and 90s, too.
Uh-huh.
They would get treated very well so that people would say that it's great.
Exactly. And what I believe happened was, and Steinbeck mentions this in the early chapters of the Russian Journal, he had dinner at the embassy with Walter Beadle Smith. And it's not too far a stretch from Smith saying, while you're traveling around, can you do us a favor? Just observe. Do what you do best, and then report back to us. And I think that's what happened. And there were a number of instances in Steinbeck's FBI file that during that time period, the CIA has redacted information. And once again, I've gotten about all out of the CIA that I'm going to get, because they won't release any information about past or present covert operations. So what we're left with is a lot of circumstantial evidence that marries up. And in speaking with his son, Thomas Steinbeck, who's an author of his own right, Thomas can't confirm or deny it because he was a young man during this time period. He was born in 44. So he's, 10, 11, 12 years old while this is going on. But he had a number of anecdotes for me. Like, they lived in Paris in 1954 for a few months. And every few days, somebody from the State Department would pop off an attaché case for John. And every few days, they would come and pick it back up. Thomas has no idea what that was about. They would also have a little game every Thursday. John would take him and Thomas and his brother out, and they would do what they call getting lost in Paris. And John would just kind of pick a random direction to go in, and they'd go somewhere. And Thomas said invariably, John would always meet somebody that he knew wherever they went. So Thomas believes that it's very likely that John was making contact with someone that was agency related and using him and his brother as a cover.
Yeah, that's very strange. Anybody listening, I always talk to the guests on the show before we actually do the interview. And Brian had mentioned this little story about Paris and getting lost in Paris. And I, just from that alone, I said, I got to have you on, you know. That's just incredible. To me, when you tell these stories, maybe it's just, you know, the creative mind going, but I understand that Steinbeck was what is or can be described as a passive kind of intelligence gatherer, but you watch, Hollywood's going to get a hold of this. They're going to come to you, and they're going to turn it into an epic movie where Steinbeck is going to have, like, a handler, and he's going to be, like, a sniper.
Well, that has been mentioned by someone. I can't talk about too many details, but it could be a possibility. I don't know. But at this point, it's difficult to get the word out because, you know, we talked about the whole conspiracy angle earlier. Most of the mainstream media at this point has kind of shunned me in academia, too, because they think that I'm the tinfoil hat guy. And the academics out there that have reviewed the work have been very guarded about what they've said because they missed it for years. And along comes me, a guy who went to college for finance and economics, who found this out, and it was under everyone's nose the entire time. Why I figured it out, I don't know. My wife is quick to tell me that it was just my story to tell. And once again, but it was fascinating being able to do it. And like I said, spent a number of years of my life on and off working on this. So glad to finally have a finished product and what I consider to be a great body of evidence that I present in the book to further my case.
Yeah, it's the whole story together is amazing. And the way I view it is, you know, people might think that you are a conspiracy theorist or whatever, but you can't have, there's no conspiracy here. I mean, the conspiracy is maybe pondering the what ifs.
Right.
When thinking about his position, there is no conspiracy to be had when you have the document in hand, in his writing, asking, I'd like to work for the CIA as an intelligence gatherer, or whatever, you know, his involvement was. And the CIA, you know, the director, saying, sure, yeah, that'd be great.
Well, I know.
There, so.
Yeah, I know. I mean, this is all very historical. I've got documentation for this. And even there are other clues in his FBI file. Like in 1957, the CIA's Office of Security requested information about Steinbeck from the FBI. Well, the Office of Security in the CIA in 1957 does pretty much what it does today. They're in charge of vetting personnel, keeping CIA facilities and data safe. So why in the world would the Office of Security of the CIA request information about John Steinbeck unless Steinbeck was already in the CIA system? If it was counterintelligence, like they thought Steinbeck was giving information to the Russians or someone else, the Office of Counterintelligence would have asked for that information, not the Office of Security. So I talk about this in the book, but it's kind of like looking for extrasolar planets. You know, a number of years ago, we had never seen a planet outside our solar system, but two astronomers found one around a pulsar by looking at the anomalies of that starlight, and they could see a regular pattern of something passing in front of the star. So mathematically, they proved that extrasolar planets exist. Well, looking at anything covert, since we're never going to get the full story out of an intelligence agency, you have to do the same thing. You look for the anomalies. You look for the things that don't make sense. You look for the connections, and they're all there.
All right, so I wanted to get back to a little bit. Some of the people, you know, listening know, like I said earlier, that I only do, you know, guests and things that are either Masons or want to talk about Masons, things like that, Masonic subjects, we try to keep it to. And in this one, we have double hit. We have Brian Kennard, who is a Mason, author and publisher, talking about John Steinbeck, in his case, who also was a Mason. So what can you tell us about John Steinbeck's Masonic affiliations and some stories relating to that?
Well, it's not very well known that he actually was a Master Mason and belonged to Salinas Lodge number 204, I believe, in California. Everyone knows, and his biographies hit on the fact that he was in the DeMolay Society, and his father was a Mason. But I had contacted a past master from the Salinas Lodge who was able to confirm that he was a Mason. I know there have been some outlets now that have been able to report that, but at the time, it wasn't very widely known, or if at all. But at Thomas Steinbeck had told me about his membership in the lodge and how he was always very, very proud of the fact that he was a Mason. And John became a Mason in the 20s, and I don't believe he kept his membership up, but he always carried his last dues card in his wallet. And according to Thomas, they, in the numerous trips to Europe, he said they visited the Imperial War Museum in London. And Tom told me, he said, yeah, it's amazing what kind of doors throwing the handshake will get you in at the Imperial War Museum. But, you know, I think that one of the things that actually helps my case is Steinbeck learned at a very early age, just like all of us that are Masons do, how to keep a secret and the importance of secrecy within an organization. So covert operations were not too far a step from him for that. And of course, most Masons are very, very patriotic. And this was one of the reasons that John did all this. He was denied service in World War II because of his supposed communist affiliations. And he was a war correspondent during World War II, and there's a lot that goes on with that, too, in the book. But he hated communism, or Soviet-style communism. Tom had told me that American communists during the time didn't worry John so much because they couldn't get out of bed in time to attend any kind of rallies or anything. But the Stalinist communism that suppressed creative thinkers and authors in particular, not to mention the atrocities that Stalin perpetrated upon the Russian people, Steinbeck saw that as if the communists were able to get a foothold into the world at large, the world would be plunged into a dark age. And that's almost a direct quote from a letter that Steinbeck had written that his friend Bo Badeski, that was a Swedish painter. So it's very, very clear what Steinbeck's thoughts were on communism. And it was John's way of being able to serve his country in an equal measure to those that were combat veterans in World War II. So
makes sense. You know, it's something I'm sure anybody would do, is if you are patriotic enough and you really want to serve your country, you have to do what you can do if you've been denied service. I mean, I wasn't able to serve. I tried to enlist in different services, and I was denied for various reasons, mostly because of eyesight. You know, I try to do everything I can for Veterans Affairs. Like, you know, I try to promote. I have a number of friends who are representatives for organizations like USA Cares, my buddy Rob Lewis, who's also a brother, and several other people. You know, you find a way to help the veteran cause, or at the very least to help your country out in some fashion. And it sounds like, you know, he found his niche.
Exactly. And it all goes along with the Masonic ideals of service. And once again, helping out. It all goes hand in hand. And as an aggregate, it all makes sense when you view Steinbeck in that manner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, one thing I wanted to ask is, the book is out now, or is it on the way?
No, it is out now.
So the book is out now, Steinbeck Citizen Spy, and I know it's on Amazon.com, but as with a lot of independent publishers, perhaps there is another link that you would rather link it to instead?
You can go to GraveDistractions.com and find out where it's all at. Walmart picked it up on their website, which was kind of cool. But we're available in print in all the usual places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. We're also available in ebook formats, just about every ebook format that you can think of in place. And then in the iBook store for Amazon Kindle, for the Nook. So we're everywhere. We also are always looking for authors. I would love to work with brothers that have got Masonic book ideas. Give me a call. My email is at gravedistractions.com, and we'll sit down and talk about it.
Very cool, very cool. So anybody listening, I'm going to have a link on the website, www.wcypodcast.com. If you click on the tab for the bookstore, you're going to see Steinbeck's Citizen Spy right there. You can click on that, and that's going to take you over to the link to the book, and it'll either take you to the Amazon.com or directly to Grave Distractions Publishing Company's page for the book, where you can pick it up. As Brian said, it's going to be on Walmart, it's on Kindle, it's on almost every ebook format there is. So you're going to have to go out and pick this one up. I know I'm going to. It sounds fascinating, and it's out right now. Is there a way that brothers can follow Grave Distractions on Twitter or on Facebook or anything?
Oh, yeah. We're on Facebook. We have a fan page. You can friend me personally, too, if you want. We're on Twitter at GraveDistract. Like a big dummy, I forgot the book has its own website, which is SteinbeckCitizensSpy.com. And I've got one of the documents up and an excerpt from the book, too. So if you want to check that out, it's all there in information on how to do a Freedom of Information Act request and a couple articles about that type thing, links to Steinbeck sites. It's got links to espionage sites and intelligence services sites throughout the world if you're interested in that type thing. So that's SteinbeckCitizensSpy.com. But yeah, follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Drop me an email. My phone number's on the Grave Distraction site. Love to hear from you, and I appreciate you having me on today.
The honor's all mine, brother. I thought it was just fantastic, and I can't wait to read this book. I know everybody out there who's listening, especially the guys who asked about conspiracy stuff, and we're all going to love it. So I just want to thank you again for spending some time with us. I know you're a busy guy being a publisher and an artist.
Thank you.
All right, again, you can check out all of the information to get this book via the show notes, as well as through WCYpodcast.com on the bookstore. You can find everything also on GraveDistractions.com and also on SteinbeckCitizenSpy.com as well. Okay, let's get into this week's famous Freemason. Many times I like to cover Masons who were worldwide known to everyone, but on occasion, I might offer up an obscure one. This brother is well known to men in the fraternity and probably not so much to the brothers who might be listening that are not brothers yet. You never know. So I'm going to condense probably the most well-known Mason to Masons in a few paragraphs, and I hope you all don't hold it against me. It's just that there is way too much to cover in this little segment. Born December 29th, 1809, was the oldest of six children, born to Benjamin and Sarah Andrews Pike, brother Albert Pike. Pike was raised in a Christian home and attended an Episcopal church. Pike passed the entrance examination to Harvard College when he was 15 years old, but could not attend because he had no funds. After traveling as far west as Santa Fe, Pike settled in Arkansas, where he worked as an editor of a newspaper before being admitted to the bar. In Arkansas, he met Mary Ann Hamilton and married her on November 28, 1834. To this union were born 11 children. He was 41 years old when he applied for admission in the Western Star Lodge No. 2 in Little Rock, Arkansas. In 1850, active in the Grand Lodge of Arkansas, Pike took the 10 degrees of the York Rite from 1850 to 1853. He received the 29 degrees of the Scottish Rite in March 1853 from Albert Gallatin Mackey in Charleston, South Carolina. The boundary between the southern and northern jurisdictions still recognized today was firmly established in 1828. Mackey invited Pike to join the Supreme Council for the Southern Jurisdiction in 1858 in Charleston, and he became the Grand Commander of the Supreme Council the following year. Pike held the office until his death while supporting himself in various occupations such as editor of the Memphis Daily Appeal from February 1867 to September of 1868, as well as his law practice. Pike later opened a law office in Washington, D.C., and argued a number of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. However, Pike was impoverished by the Civil War, and remained so much of his life, often borrowing money for basic living expenses from the Supreme Council before the Council voted him an annuity in 1879 of $1,200 a year for the remainder of his life. He died on April 2, 1892, in Washington, D.C. Realizing that a revision of the ritual was necessary if Scottish Rite Freemasonry were to survive, Mackey encouraged Pike to revise the ritual to produce a standard ritual for use in all states in the southern jurisdiction. Revision began in 1855, and after some changes, the Supreme Council endorsed Pike's revision in 1861. Minor changes were made in 2 degrees in 1873 after the York Rite bodies in Missouri objected that the 29th and 30th degrees revealed secrets of the York Rite. Pike is best known for his major work, Morals and Dogma of the Ancient and Accepted Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, published in 1871. Morals and Dogma should not be confused with Pike's revision of the Scottish Rite ritual. They are separate works. Walter Lee Brown writes that Pike, quote, indeed it, Morals and Dogma, to be a supplement to that great connected system of moral, religious, and philosophical instruction that he had developed in his revision of the Scottish ritual, end quote. Morals and Dogma was traditionally given to the candidate upon his receipt of the 14th degree of the Scottish Rite. This practice was stopped in 1974. Morals and Dogma has not been given to candidates since 1974. A Bridge to Light by Rex R. Hutchins is provided to candidates today. Hutchins laments that Morals and Dogma is read by so few Masons. A Bridge to Light was written to be a bridge between the ceremonies of the degrees and their lectures in Morals and Dogma. While recommended to Masons, we cannot conclude that Masons are expected to accept every thought in A Bridge to Light. Books by liberal theologians and writings by non-Christian philosophers are assigned by professors in Baptist colleges and seminaries. Students are not expected to accept the teachings found in these books and writings. Rather, they are assigned to help students understand the thoughts of men of the past and their struggle to understand themselves and their relationship to God. With exposure to these ideas, students can better form and defend their own understanding of these critical issues. All right, that's it for this week. Please remember to find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Whence Came You. Remember to check out the Midnight Freemasons 3 times a week for original content, which is always fresh and always new. If you like what you read there, then you can continue on and check out the Working Tools magazine, the largest independent Masonic magazine in America, where we are featured each month with original pieces that are exclusive to the magazine. You can check it out at twtmag.com for details. And you can also follow them on Twitter at TWTMag. And you can also follow the Midnight Freemasons on Twitter as well at Midnight Mason. And before I move on, I did want to say congratulations to Brother Aaron Gardner, who has joined us and accepted a regular contributor spot on the Midnight Freemasons. So, Brother Aaron, welcome home, and thank you for accepting the offer. Also, you can check out our podcast partners, Rob Lewis on Far From Centered and Juan Sepulveda on The Winding Stairs, which are both on iTunes. Check out some of the Masonic businesses on our site as well, PB&J Water for all your water purification needs, and FraternalTies.com for the best Masonic neckties and bow ties anywhere. No more cheese ball, plain square, and compasses repeated all over a tie. Nope, how about original designs that are beautiful? Go ahead and check those out when you can at FraternalTies.com. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.